Hello everybody and welcome to this new episode. My name is Sarah and this is Amsterdamus, the podcast that introduces you to amazing women from Amsterdam. Dear Sarah, thanks for being a fellow journalist who cares about justice and human rights. These words came from Friederike Gerding, and they were written in a book that a dear friend gave me as a gift. Friederike Gerding is a Dutch journalist who specializes in reporting on Kurdish people and political issues in Turkey. Her work has been nominated for the Brussel Prize, an annual prize for the best journalistic book in the Netherlands. The nomination stated, Friederike Gerding is one of those courageous Dutch journalists who do their work in dangerous conflict zones. Her book became a both political and beautiful personal account of the struggle for self-determination in Turkish Kurdistan. Welcome, Friederike Gerding.
Nice to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
I learned about your work when I received your latest book for my birthday last year. My dear friend Olga, she gave it to me with a special signature that you gave for me, and I was in full fan mode.
Yeah, very sweet.
Your book is called This Fire Never Dies, 1 year with the PKK. To make sure that we are all on the same page here, could you quickly explain who is the PKK?
The PKK is Partia Karkeren Kurdistan. That's the acronym, meaning Workers' Party of Kurdistan. So it's the armed Kurdish movement.
How is the PKK seen around the world, in Europe especially?
Depends a little bit on who you ask. If you ask most of the governments in Europe, they would say it's a terrorist organization. That our loyal ally Turkey is heroically fighting against. not all countries in Europe, by the way. In Norway, Norway doesn't say it's a terrorist organization. If you ask like average white Europeans, they have heard about, you know, the violence, and they are not, they also know that Kurds are being suppressed. And people who are a little bit more knowledgeable about Kurdistan and Turkey, they know that it's an armed movement that strives for more autonomy for Kurds, for self-determination, and for full respect of their political and social rights.
How did you start working in this region? How did that happen?
I was a Turkey correspondent, freelance. I went to Turkey in 2006. And in the beginning, I did just the average correspondence work for all kinds of... not the average correspondence work, I wouldn't say. That's wrong. Because I didn't really do hard news. I did more background stories for all kinds of magazines, actually. Human rights magazine, travel magazines, women's magazines, like even a farmer's magazine. Like, you know, anybody who wanted anything about Kurdistan could knock on my door about Turkey. And then late 2011, a massacre happened. The Turkish state bombed a group of border traders or smugglers on the Turkish-Iraqi border, and 34 people were killed, civilians, 19 of them underaged. And I went to the village for a day to make two stories, one for a news agency and one for a youth magazine. And it's, I don't know, I was there for one day and I got more new questions than questions were answered, you know. So I kept going there. That resulted in my first book, The Boys Are Dead, in which I explained the Kurdish issue. But it was also very much a journey for myself to get to know Turkey from from the Kurdish perspective. And then I found this perspective very interesting and very important. So I decided to keep on reporting from Kurdistan. And that was, I don't know, that book was published in Dutch in 14. And then I stayed in Kurdistan. I moved from Istanbul to Diyarbakir in the southeast of Turkey. And yeah.
During your work, you have been arrested twice. What was the reason?
I'm having a coffee in the meantime. So maybe people hear the sound from the background. And then you may be annoyed, like, oh, we have this sound and it's distracting. But if you know it's coffee, then it's okay. So I'm saying it.
Enjoy coffee. It. You deserve it.
The first time was in January 2015. Terrorism police in front of my door. They searched my house and they detained me. And they questioned me because they were investigating me for making propaganda for a terrorist organization. And that lasted a couple of hours. So I was back home again at night. And the second time was in early September 2015. I was further to the southeast even. Yuksekova, which is close to the Iranian border. Making a story somewhere in the valley, and when I, with a group of Kurds, and when we went back to the village where they came from, we were, you know, there was a police check and we were all detained and spent 2 days in the police station, very classical, in like the basement of the police station. And then the women in the group were released, and I thought, okay, I'm going to continue my travel. But then I was expelled, and I haven't been able to return ever since.
Maybe as an additional information for our listeners, being a freelancer and being arrested usually means there's no media to back you up. If you are a staff writer for a certain newspaper, that comes with a bit of safety in these kind of cases, but... In your case, you were on your own, right?
Yeah, but I had a large Twitter following already. And the first time when I was in the police station, they said like, you know, everybody knows that you're here. And yeah, you know, they allowed me to send a tweet. It went viral instantly. And that day, I don't know if it was a coincidence or not, but the Dutch foreign minister was visiting Turkey. And he also... heard. So then the whole visit of the foreign minister evolved around me. I heard that only much later. I thought it was sort of a sideline, you know, in between all the economic stuff. But apparently the whole visit turned out to be about me. So he backed me up. And also the second time I could also send a tweet, and then the embassy was standing up for me. And media also, you know, it's not only media who can... Media, it's nice if they back you up, but they can't really change the situation. One of the magazines I write for, Dutch people know it, Groene Amsterdammer. When I was back in the Netherlands, I wanted to make a story about... the first thing is like, come visit us. And they were supporting me, and they immediately accepted a few pitches from me. You know, like, okay, we're going to keep you going, you know, don't worry. So it's not only the staff writers that get support. It's also if magazines have a conscience and are in support of press freedom, they will treat you properly, you know.
For your latest book, you spend a lot of time in PKK camps. You spoke to the fighters, but you also spoke to ordinary people in the villages. Could you describe what it was like to live there? What was your experience, or what were your expectations, and what was it like in the end?
For this book, I was really mainly in the camps. Well, I think the first scene in the book really sort of sums it all up. It was in the summer of 2016. I was first put in a language camp because many Kurds don't know their mother tongue. So if they want, they can go to a language course. And they told me, like, if you want to stay here for some time, it's a good idea that you go to a language course as well. And my Kurdish was shit and still is, by the way. But I found it a good idea. So I was in a language camp. And it was very hot. It was summer. And we were building a pool in the river. Like you block part of the river so the current becomes weaker and you can swim. It was a very cold river, so perfect. And then one of the fighters came, who was still in the camp, came running to us and she said, there's been a coup in Turkey, military coup. But it already happened the day before. It happened on the 15th of July and I heard it on the 16th. And I was very frustrated to be there because in the camp you could get Kurdish TV, which I couldn't follow very properly, and they didn't give it that much attention. Or there was Turkish TV, and they were having a very one-sided story. And I had no access to my phone. It was too dangerous there. And I thought I have to get away from here because the news is happening now, and I need to talk to fighters who know what's going on. Because in the language camp, nobody was really, of course, you know, up to date. But I couldn't leave there easily. It was somewhere in the mountains, you know, under the trees. I wasn't sure where exactly I was. You can't just leave the camp and go somewhere. It's dangerous. I was very frustrated. I thought, shit, I am here to see how the PKK handles such a news, how people talk about it. And I'm here in the language camp. But then when it sunk in and I knew that I couldn't go anywhere, I thought, this is what the fighters do. They make their homework, their conjugations, and they learn words. This is what they do. And there's a coup going on in Turkey, but it's not their task to do anything about it. They're there to learn the language, and they do their task, and they're very dedicated to whichever task they choose or get. And that was, I thought I was going to this revolutionary movement, very fast and fighting. And I was asking everybody about their weapons and they all said, like, you know, the weapons are not so important, you know. And then I had to sort of slow down to the pace of the revolution that they are making. They call it a revolution. And I never thought that the revolution was slow, but it's slow. So I had to, you know, slow down as well and not be, you know, freaking out about who is saying what in Turkey and, you know, blah, blah, or in Iraq or in Syria. You know, I had to slow down. And that was a very frustrating but very good lesson. And with that, I could go on. And that's also why I think that it was very important that I stayed for 1 year, not in the language camp, but in other camps as well, to feel that. If you go for a week or if you do 5 interviews in 5 camps and, you know, there's people who do that. There was this Turkish journalist who went for 1 afternoon and then he made a book, you know. Like, you know, it's not possible. You have to be in their world to understand what it is.
I think I also learned a lesson of myself about myself with what you just said, because you spoke about the military coup and you said a fighter came running to tell you about it. And yeah, you said she. And in my mind, of course, a PKK fighter is a man, which is absolutely not feminist of me. But no. Yeah, in my mind, it was a man. So what's the role of women? They are actively part of the revolution, obviously.
Yeah, they lead the revolution. They lead it. And that is not just a marketing thing because they're not into marketing. The PKK is not, because you asked in the beginning, what's PKK? And I already said, like, they're after self-determination, which doesn't equal having a nation state. They are not after having a Kurdistan nation state with borders and a flag and all this. They are anti-patriarchal, and they see nation states and capitalism as patriarchal systems that are, you know, keeping each other alive. They cannot live without each other. And this is what they fight. In the beginning of PKK, they were founded in 1978. They did want an independent Kurdistan, but then, of course, their roots are Marxist. And of course, in the 80s and 90s, they started thinking like, hey, what is the cause of socialism in practice going so terribly wrong? And they said in the former Soviet Union, or it was breaking down at the time, and all these countries, they didn't break down the patriarchy, and it was still a very strong centrally governed state. So we have to fight this. If we want an independent Kurdistan, an independent nation state, we're going to repeat these mistakes. So we have to develop another model. And their inspiration came from an American anarchist, or he, in the later part of his life, he didn't call himself an anarchist anymore, but his name is Murray Bookchin. And Öcalan, the leader of PKK, he's in jail since 1999. He developed the ideas of Murray Bookchin into something that was applicable to the countries where Kurds live. So Turkey, Iraq, Iran, and Syria, but also for the whole region. People say Middle East, but a friend always tells me it's not the Middle East, it's West Asia. But if I say West Asia, people say like West Asia. So the basics is like grassroots democracy. So people have neighborhood councils, village councils, city councils. They have real, it's not participation. They really make the policies for their neighborhood, for their town, for their... also because they say this region of the world, you cannot, nation states are not logical here, because the whole region is historically multi-religious, like the big monotheist religions have their origins there, but there are many smaller religions as well, like Yazidis, for example. And it's multilingual, and it's multi-ethnic, multicultural. So whichever nation state you make, there's going to be minorities, and they are, per definition, going to be in trouble. So we have to, and also this nation state concept was imported from the West. And they say it's not, maybe, you know, you can do that in the West. It also doesn't make sense in the West anyway, but, you know, it was important to our region in the world, and we don't want it. We need to make a system that respects the, you know, inherent diversity of this region. So nation states are bad. So it's anti-patriarchal, and that makes it, that makes women like the leaders of the revolution.
What were your personal challenges? What were you struggling with the most during this year?
Walking in the mountains is the first thing that came up. I fell a few times. And in the dark, oh my God. Walking in the dark in the forest, in the mountains. I mean, and there was a German woman also in the language camp, a German woman. Well, she learned it very fast, but she was very young. That's my excuse. I wasn't young. I was in my 40s. But that's really hard. And I felt very clumsy. And they said, it's normal because you grew up in the city, you know. You're not, and in a flat country and in a city. So it's not very strange. But I go down the mountain very slowly. And in the dark, I, you know, really, like one of the fighters brought me to my tent late at night, and she was holding my hand, leading me through the forest, and she was very confident, and I was like and actually falling, like, that was very funny. So that's the thing that came up, that, you know, like a practical thing, you know. It's really one of the fighters in this language camp, she was like a goat the way she walked through the mountains. And then it turned out that her father was a shepherd, and she had been with him most of her childhood, so she grew up, you know, as a shepherd's daughter from a very young age. It was really wonderful. But for the rest, it's important to learn that the revolution is slow. That is an important lesson, because we are very much inclined to, or it's one of the fighters said, like, yeah, you Western people in capitalist world, you think your period of time is like your lifetime, or maybe your mortgage, but you have to, revolutions take time. And because I said they believe that capitalism is not compatible with humankind because it divides people and people are herd animals. So we have to, the capitalism is not compatible with community life. So eventually capitalism is going to fall. And I said, do you expect this to happen in your life? And they would say, no, but that's not the point. Maybe it will, maybe it will not. But we're building here, we're building structures so that it can be implemented when the time is right. And it happened in Syria, for example, when the war broke out in 2012. The regime troops were withdrawn from the Kurdish areas, and then the sister groups of the PKK, because it's a very big movement now with different groups in different countries, they immediately thought, okay, this is our chance. We never thought it would be in Syria because Syria is such a bad dictatorship. But now we get our chance here. So everybody, you know, started working there on the structures they had already thought about so much. They had practiced as much as they could in Turkey. So you have to be ready, and you're building structures for maybe the very long future. And that is, yeah, that I found very important.
If we speak a bit more about women journalists in general, of course, we are facing risks that our male colleagues do not have to face. On the other hand, from my personal experience in crisis zones, I also see a lot of benefits in being a female journalist. What is your stand on that?
It's funny that always, I had an interview on Dutch radio this week and they also started about women, but your question doesn't have prejudice, but their question did have it. Like, oh, in the Middle East there's a woman.
Oh God, they came up with, oh no.
That's so much prejudice against, you know, like people here often cannot believe that in West Asia there could be a more feminist movement than any Western feminist could ever imagine, you know?
Yeah, I also recently heard an interview with Antonia Rados, who is one of the most famous German-speaking foreign correspondents. She was in Iraq multiple times. She actually interviewed Saddam, I believe, at some point. And they asked her, so did you become a war reporter because you wanted to prove yourself in a man's world? And I was so offended on her account.
Yeah. Yeah, also like as if the whole world is not a man's world also.
Absolutely.
Like, you know, you wouldn't ask that to, they would not ask her that question if she had stayed in Germany. But, you know, it makes just as much sense, really. Or just as little sense, actually. But being a woman is, you know, you get access to, especially in a women's movement, of course, you get access to conversation and to places that men don't get access to, because the men and women are like, there's men and women camps, there's no mixed camps. Or in the language camp, there were men, but there, the most of the people there were women. Like our tents there, we were not sleeping in a cave or whatever, but in one person tents. And the women's part of the camp was on one side of the language camp, and or to the common area and the classrooms under the trees. And then 5 minutes walk to the other side was the men's camp. And you don't mix, like the men don't come in the women's part and vice versa. And women are important in this struggle. So as a man, it would have definitely been a very different book, and you get less access to what really matters. But also, most of the education is mixed, like in the language camp also, like in the classes people are mixed. There's a lot of education in PKK on all different subjects. I also did a history, short history course. But also, I was in a camp around Kirkuk in West Iraq, and they had a... There's one course that they do separately, and this course is about, like, if you want to fight the patriarchy, you also have to think about and reflect and work on the ways that patriarchy has influenced you as a person. And of course, patriarchy has different effects on men and on women. So that is the only course that men and women follow separately. So I followed that with women. But I was very curious, of course, how men among each other reflect on how the patriarchy has influenced them. But no way I could get in, you know. No women allowed here. but for my book would be so, yeah, very interesting, but no. So sometimes you don't have access, but having access to the women's camps was crucial for this project, definitely.
In the past years, the tone against journalists has become a lot rougher. Did you also notice that in your work, personally?
No, not really. I still work on Kurdistan, even though since the beginning of the pandemic I've been in the Netherlands. I don't know, the people who would harass me, I've blocked them already. And in the Netherlands, because I tweet in English, in the Netherlands I'm not that much part of the filthy conversation in the Netherlands, luckily. No, it's for me. Yeah, but it's also a relative thing, because like 3 weeks ago I was kicked out of Kurdistan in Iraq. That didn't have anything to do with me being a woman. But I see it also as a consequence of what I do. Because Kurdistan in Iraq, I was on the way to Kurdistan in Syria. I was stopped at the border, which I had permission to cross. But at the very last moment, they withdrew the permission. And the Kurdish leadership in Kurdistan in Iraq is cooperating with Turkey against the PKK. And they are very corrupt. Like very corrupt. They even say it themselves. We have to tackle the corruption. You know, they even admit it, but you know, it's very bad. And it's very much a clan system and very authoritarian, increasingly authoritarian, also against local journalists. And I write about it. So if I write about that and they would just leave me running around there, people would say like, you know, is it correct what you're writing, that it's becoming more authoritarian and Erdogan's influence is increasing, but you're just reporting there. You know, it's a consequence of the position I take as a journalist against power and, you know, reporting from another perspective, an anti-power perspective, so to speak. So it's a consequence of what I do. So I don't really see it as an increasing. What I actually think is, and I've written this also about, it's even a worse situation, of course, but also when you look at which journalists are murdered, Khashoggi, for example, of Daphne Caruana Galizia in Malta. These are people that, especially Malta, but of course Khashoggi too, because if you criticize Saudi Arabia, it's a very, like, you cross borders very quickly. These are the people, and I'm doing that too, but of course the consequences for me are much smaller, of course, but if all journalists would oppose power more strongly and take a more strong position, not want to have access to power, if you still have access to Erdogan's palace, you're doing something wrong, you know? And if we all do that, but also in the Netherlands, all the journalists in The Hague, at where the government is, they all want scoops from the minister, from the prime minister. If we stop doing that, and if we all take a position, you know, to really investigate and speak truth to power, which is, I think, one of the most important things journalism should do, then they can't kill us all. They cannot expel us all. They cannot silence us all, you know. So it's the people who are the most outspoken that get in trouble. And then, of course, journalists say, oh, press freedom, this and that. Yeah, but you are also on the lap of those in power. Get off, you know, take off your shiny shoes, put on boots, and go into whichever country you work in and get the stories from the people. And then, of course, for the side of the government, you call them and you say, hey, I found this and that. And what's your response and what's your reaction, you know? So I think that is, you know, all the lip service that there are many good journalists, you know, I have to say this too, of course, in the Netherlands, everywhere, there are plenty of good journalists, but there's also a lot of journalism that is too close to power, and they also pay lip service to press freedom. But if they really want to make a contribution, they all change their perspective, but they don't, because they think they are objective, like in there's research into this as well. Detached watchdogs, that's what they think they are. Mainly white men, actually. And they think they're very much outsiders and they have an objective view, but they don't know that objectivity doesn't exist and that white glasses are tainted too, you know. So they should reflect on their position and see that they are part of the group in society that has power and step away from that. And then they would really contribute to creating more space for press freedom.
What are your future steps in your work? Are you trying to get back?
Yeah, I'm not sure how to, maybe I can go to the southern part of Kurdistan in Iraq, but the places in Kurdistan where I can go are getting smaller and smaller. And maybe there's another way to Syria. I'm not sure yet. I'm now making a story about Kobani from a distance because I was going to this city in Syria, in Kurdistan in Syria. I'm making that story anyway, but then from a distance, there's important developments going on there. Like 2 months ago, I made a story in Scotland, actually, also about people standing up to power, about financial power, actually. And I'm making stories in the Netherlands also with this in the back of my head, like, you know, talking to the people who try to break the power structures that are ruining their lives. So that is sort of a story that you can get in many places in the world. And I'm working for a website, medianews.net, which is a English language website from the Kurdish movements in Europe, writing columns, doing podcasts now and then, and, you know, like many different stories I'm working on.
How can people support you and your work?
Oh, you would want to subscribe to my Kurdistan newsletter. That would be the best, because if you go to my Twitter account, fgeerdink, F-G-E-E-R-D-I-N-K, the link in the bio is to my to the website of the newsletter. It's paid, but it's cheap, especially for what you get. And it's a growing audience, and I give a solid update about Kurdistan every week. So that would make me the happiest.
I'll also make sure to put all the information in the show notes so people can definitely find it.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Frederike, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I'm still super hyped that I was able to talk to you.
Oh, very sweet. Thanks. Well, thanks for having me. I like talking about it and talking to you and, you know, spread the word also about, you know, anti-patriarchal struggles. It's important. So thanks for having me.
I totally second that. Thank you very much. Keep up the good work. And I'm sure you are a huge inspiration, not only to me, but also to other female journalists.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
And that's it for today's episode. Thank you very much for tuning in and for supporting this podcast. If you want to support Amsterdamus even more, there are several options to do so. You can check out the Amsterdamus Facebook page and leave a review. Depending on which podcast app you are using to listen to this podcast, you can also rate Amsterdamus there with a 5-star review. In Apple Podcasts, for example, it is possible. Of course, you can also follow Amsterdamus on Instagram. In case you would like to give me some feedback, or you know a person that needs to be interviewed for this podcast, you can send me an email. The email address is amsterdamuspodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again and have a great day.